the afternoon was Sackville of Dublin.
Judging by your reception, it would be quite superfluous of me to say any more, Sackville.
Mr. Chairman, Your Excellency, my Lord Bishop, and good afternoon to you all. I am an alcoholic. I belong to the Dublin Groups of Alcoholics Anonymous. My Christian name is Sackville. And by the grace of God, as I understand them, and through that grace, the help, continuing help of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been a non-drinking alcoholic since the day I joined our fellowship. I want to start by bringing the best wishes for your success and happiness from all our members in Ireland, north, south, east, and west. And also our sincere thanks to the England and Wales members for arranging and convening this very first all-European conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. The last time I had the privilege of speaking to an England and Wales convention was at Clacton in 1965. And since then, the Scots, with their usual generosity, have invited me up for the last 4 years to their convention at Dunblane. The first 2 years on the understanding that I would speak to them, the last 2 years on a clearer understanding that I wouldn't. But at the invitation to speak here this afternoon, which I value very deeply, is saddened with sorrow for me, because I'm only speaking here as a very unworthy substitute for Bill, our co-founder. Bill, to me, was a very, very great man, and he was also humble and generous enough to number me amongst his personal friends. There was a poem written by a man in grief for the death of one of his friends. It's very well known. The first line is this: "They tell me you are dead, Heraclitus. They tell me you are dead." And the last two lines are these: "Still are thy pleasant voices, thy nightingales awake. For death, he taketh all away, but them he cannot take." Bill's pleasant voices, his nightingales still awake, are his books and his writings that he's left behind for us. And in the last book that he wrote, Yea, Way of Life, his final words to us were these: "Yours in trust and in affection, Bill." He trusted us to take on AA from where he had to leave it down himself. That we can do, and that by God's grace we will do. But for his affection, his devotion, and his work for us all, which one of us can ever start even to say thank you for that? I had a visitor from Virginia a couple of months ago who was 30 years a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And knowing he'd been fairly close to Bill in the earlier years, I asked him if he had any special memory. And he said, "Why, Bill himself brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous. He'd heard through a mutual acquaintance that I was in very bad shape. And so he came along for 3 days running, and he talked to me long and eloquently about the advantages for me of joining Alcoholics Anonymous. And he didn't make the slightest impression on me at all. And then he came a fourth time. And this day, everything he said seemed to make sense to me. And I couldn't help asking him, 'Why didn't you talk to me like that before, Bill?' He said, 'I can remember Bill smiling at me and just saying, but I did, Dave. It's just, you weren't listening.'" Father Eddie Darling, an American Jesuit, one of Bill's earliest friends and supporters of Alcoholics Anonymous, came over to Dublin to talk to us once. He began his talk like this: "I'm a very poor speaker, so I ask you to listen to me, not only with your ears, but with your hearts. And for the very same reason that Father Eddie gave, I ask the same favor of you this afternoon. And 2 years after Connor had started our group in Dublin, the end of November 1946, he came back and paid us a return visit. And we had him to speak at our weekly public meeting at the country shop. And after the meeting was over, a man came up to him and said, what you've been talking about this evening has convinced me that I'm an alcoholic. And also that Alcoholics Anonymous could give me a great deal of help. But he said, my difficulty is this. I'm the managing director of a very large concern in Dublin. And I'm a member of one or two public committees. And you can see that a man in my position in life couldn't afford to associate with anything like Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, Connor, what's your problem? And just go on drinking. And then when you've lost your position in life, come back to us again. My alcoholic drinking stretched over about 30 years. And it cost me my career, my profession. I got a letter from the War Office one day, very politely telling me they'd accepted my resignation from the Army. The strange thing about that was, I don't remember ever having sent it in to them. I'd lost my physical health through alcoholism. I've been in 30 homes and hospitals. 30 or 40 doctors and specialists have had me through their hands. And the end result of this, I can only call it medical liaison, was that I was drinking just as hard as ever at the end of it. And for the last 10 years, I was taking drugs and sleeping pills as well and as freely as drink. One of my last doctors, for some reason I couldn't understand at that time, told me that if I didn't stop drinking very soon, he'd have to put me away in a mental home for the rest of my life. That at least wasn't a problem. I just changed my doctor. But spiritually, I was bankrupt. I'd lost all faith in God and man. I was full of resentment, self-pity, and wounded pride. I was desperately unhappy most of the time, and always at an aching loneliness inside me. But I was willing to soldier on in a spiritual poverty, providing I could go on living a term on and with my mother, and provided too that the only thing I knew of and relied on in life, alcohol, wasn't taken away from me. And then one Monday morning, the end of April 1947, my world fell in on me. My mother came and woke me up out of a drunken stupor. And she told me that she and the family had all foregathered the day before and had come to the conclusion they'd reached the end of their endurance of me, and that I was to get up, go out of her house, and out of their lives for good that very day. I don't know whether any of you have had the same experience, but these announcements are always made at the very worst possible time. I haven't got the strength to pack to get out of the house. But what she said woke me up into mental sobriety straight away, and I saw with a dreadful clearness how far down in life I'd gone. And I saw also in equal clearness how that life was going to end as an outcast, drifting round the streets almost penniless, a shadow without a background. And out of sheer funk, for the first time in my life, I became willing to give up drinking altogether. There did remain one little difficulty. I hadn't the faintest idea of how to do it. Medicine apparently had failed me. My friend's advice had never been much good. My church in those days was only talking of sinful drinking. I couldn't think of anything to do, except just to admit that I was absolutely beaten and defenseless, and to send up a despairing squawk for help to a God I didn't really believe existed. And it seems to me now, looking back, that almost immediately after that, things started to go my way. I began to remember a little story I'd read in an evening paper 5 months before, A few men had formed a very small group of something called Alcoholics Anonymous. These men had said they were recovering alcoholics, and they wanted to help anybody else who drank in the same way as themselves. And then the second thing in my favor was the day that they met, the Monday, happened to be this very day. The next thing that went well was after a lot of argument, I managed to calm my mother, who had never even heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I could stay on on probation as a very, very last chance. And if these people I went to that night could do any good for me, that I could stay on, unless or until I started to drink again. After that, with alcoholic logic, I realized that I couldn't reasonably be expected to stop drinking until I'd actually met these people. And so I went out to drink myself sober for the meeting. And that was very nearly a big mistake. However, I did make that meeting that night. I arrived there drunk. There's somebody in the room who can vouch for that. Drowsy, the drugs I was taking, altogether not very receptive to new ideas. But in spite of my condition, something wonderful happened to me that night. Sometime during that meeting, I began to know without a shadow of a doubt that here I was going to recover. I was going to recover. And I was going to recover with these men who are still strangers to me. So at the end of the meeting, I got up to the top table somehow, and I gave my name in to a member who seemed strangely reluctant to have anything at all to do with it. He told me afterwards he thought I was so drunk that I wouldn't remember what I'd joined that night. However, something more wonderful has happened since. Since that moment, I've never had a drop of alcohol. And after about the first week of physical craving from the sudden withdrawal, I've never really had a serious urge to restart drinking again. Bishop Fulton Sheen once wrote, "Men are not made weaker by admitting that they're broken-hearted. For unless their hearts were broken, how else could God get in?" The last couple of years, I've been hearing a lot about this permissive age, the swinging 70s, and AA into the 70s. And sometimes seems to me that a few of us have come to a misguided conclusion that all these parrot cries mean one and the same thing. Those who tell us that our proven successful program of recovery has somehow or other in the 70s become outdated, untrendy, that the steps themselves are old-fashioned and ought to be rewritten. That anyway, the steps were only really meant as vague suggestions. And that the practice of them is purely a matter of choice for the individual member of Alcoholics Anonymous and in no way relevant to recovery. I think myself, it's dangerous for an alcoholic to think of alcoholism in any permissive terms at all. Though nowadays we maybe seem to be freer to do what we want to do, we still haven't attained the freedom of choosing the consequences of what we do elect to do. And even in the swinging 70s, natural law remains natural law. And the natural law of alcoholism is drink on and destroy yourself. And of course, our 12 steps never were merely suggestions and are not suggestions in any permissive sense. They're a tabulated experience of our earliest members who found out from their own living, their own experience, and whether they believed in God or whether they didn't believe in God, that for continued sobriety they must willingly accept for themselves a program of spiritual discipline. And those who think the 12 steps are something that they can either take or not take as members are often very prone to quote what Bill wrote in the big book. We realize that we know but little yet. But strangely enough, they never continued to quote the rest of that paragraph. And I never heard them quoting what Bill wrote in A Comes of Age, when after 21 years of experience of his own personal recovery, and after 21 years of experience of Alcoholics Anonymous members, he wrote, "Unless each AA member follows to the best of his ability our suggested 12 steps of recovery, he almost certainly signs his own death warrant. Drunkenness and disintegration are not punishments handed out by superior authority. They are the results of personal disobedience to spiritual principles. We must obey certain principles, or we die." I remember reading in an Australian paper a couple of months ago from a member who was insisting to another member that the 12 steps were purely suggestions which he need or need not carry out as he chose. And the other member said, "I was in the last World War, and I remember being sent on a novice parachute course. And when we got there, our instructor showed us a parachute made ready for a jump. And he begged us always to remember that once we had taken a jump, the only thing that stood between us and sudden death was remembering to pull the ripcord. And he showed us the ripcord on the parachute. Underneath the ripcord, there were stenciled four letters, P-U-L-L. And he said without a smile to us, 'Of course, gentlemen, you realize these four letters are purely a suggestion.'" As I grew older in AA, I'm increasingly asked, especially by non-alcoholics, why it is that after so many years of sobriety and apparent recovery, I still remain actively concerned with Alcoholics Anonymous. We're told in AA that no question about recovery is stupid. I always think that one comes pretty near the bone. Here are three reasons that I stay with Alcoholics Anonymous. First is, I'm too much of a coward to go away from it, to leave the warmth and the shelter of the fellowship, and go out into the cold and shiver by myself again. And second, I don't think I could leave it. It's part of me now. It would be like trying to shed my skin. Do you remember the story of a little schoolgirl who was asked by her teacher one day, "What's the chief use of cowhide?" And the kid replied, "The chief use of cowhide was to keep the cow together." Well, that's what AA does for me. It keeps me together so that I can live a rational, sober, contented, at rare intervals, a useful life. The third reason I hope is the best of all. That's because I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for my own recovery. Under God, I owe AA everything that I have today, everything that I may be today. I owe it my life, my health, my reason. And the greatest gift possibly that is given to me beyond recovery is the possibility of being able once again to make real friends. All over our AA world, all over the whole world, there are hundreds of thousands of members who want to be friends with us. There are hundreds of thousands of members who want us to be their friends. Hundreds of thousands of members who need our friendship, as we surely need theirs, to bolster and underpin their own trust and their own confidence in their own recoveries. So don't let us ever deny them our own friendship for reasons of shyness or reserve or perhaps an exaggerated opinion of the importance of our own private personal anonymity. I want to end with my favorite prayer. It's the prayer of the Royalist General Sir Jacob Astley in the English Civil War, who before he went out to the Battle of Newbury knelt in his tent for a moment and prayed this prayer. Lord, thou knowest how busy I must be this day. I may forget thee, but do not thou forget me. I love to you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, nobody can follow Sackville, but there is one thing I must do. I was strictly told by our convener that I wasn't to go into a long list of names of people who have helped and give them our thanks, but I know you do thank them, and I think we must give a thanks to Travis, whose hard work and dedication has made this all possible, really.